This is the download of Sport and the British from the BBC. You can find the terms and conditions on our website at bbc.co.uk/radio4. Sport and the British is presented by Claire Balding.
We've heard about sport for upper class and for middle class women, but what about working class women? How did they relate to sport? How did it shape their identity? And how come they had to wait until the men went away to war to get their sporting chance?
Sport and the British. Working women between the wars.
I'm here at the heart of Bourneville, the factory in a garden built by George Cadbury in Birmingham, and standing outside the swimming pool, which was built exclusively for the female workers here. It was known as the Girls' Baths. It says Bourneville Baths on it, 1904. Now, Cadbury's and Roundtree's were Quaker companies famous for their paternalism, and that extended to providing sports for their female as well as their male employees. Gladys Jones came to work here at the age of 14, and as far as she's concerned, this building opened up a whole new world for her.
I came from the world of the 1914 war into the Depression, and I'd only ever been swimming in the Cut, the canal down the road. So to come to a swimming pool and then you could swim every lunchtime and every evening. They supplied me with a costume and they supplied me with a towel. What more did I want?
The number of female workers in factories, large retailers and service industries was growing hugely, and the employers decided to provide them with sports facilities and equipment. So the Lions Company, famous for their tea shops, or Boots in Nottingham, Singer as in sewing machines, and some of the shipyards in Scotland provided facilities like the ones here in Bourneville. And behind me is the Cadbury Club, which gave access to table tennis or cards or snooker indoor sports. But also, there were tennis courts, hockey fields, football pitches, lacrosse fields, and athletics equipment. And there was staff provided to manage these recreations. Fiona Skillen.
There's a huge number of reasons why employers provided these facilities, and really historians are quite divided over what the motivating factors were. Some people have said it was so that the workers were healthy and fit and were able to carry out their job properly. Other people have said it was to attract workers to the companies and to stop them from striking. We have to see this in the context of the 1920s, where there's high levels of unemployment, there's strikes, particularly in areas that are dependent on heavy industry. So we're talking about the north of England, the Midlands and parts of Scotland.
Cadbury's moved here to Bourneville in 1870, and they have a huge archive department with documents and photographs going back to the early 1800s, as well as a full collection of the Bourneville Works magazine. And I'm looking at two copies here, one from 1912, where the photographs give you a really clear idea of the number of sports that women had access to, whether it was gymnastics or bowls or swimming or tennis or hockey. And sport was felt to lead to a happy and healthy workforce. And you certainly get that message from these photographs. As far as Sir William Ellis, the employer's representative in the Industrial Welfare Society, was concerned, the benefit of providing sporting opportunities would, he said, assist in brightening the lives and make less monotonous the daily toil of the workers. When you flick through the photograph albums here, you get such a clear vision of what life was like. What was happening, though, was that people were getting used to watching women play sport. And when you get through to the 1920s, the girls playing cricket and on the tennis courts here, there are people watching them. And one of the sports that benefited most from having an attentive audience was women's football. It absolutely flourished as a spectacle. And it was a product of the huge wartime munitions factories. The Mutinettes, as the women workers were known, helped to raise money for wounded soldiers and their families.
Practically every factory across the United Kingdom that was involved in war work had a ladies' football team. And many may have only played against other departments within their own factory, but teams were recorded from one end of the country to the other. But it was in Preston where the most successful team in the history of women's football was born, the Dick Kerr Ladies. Formed at Dick Kerr and Company Limited, these very ordinary working class girls quite literally took the country by storm. They always played in front of thousands of people wherever they appeared and raised thousands and thousands of pounds for charity.
Gail Newsham, the official biographer of the Dick Kerr Ladies, and she has no doubt about their place in history or their growing popularity. Of the 150 women's football clubs that came into being between the wars, Dick Kerr Ladies were by far the most popular. Many players, such as their winger Lily Parr, became local celebrities. On Boxing Day 1920, a crowd of 23,000 packed into Goodison Park to watch Lily Parr and the Dick Kerr Ladies playing St Helens Ladies. Now, a crowd that size should be cause for celebration. But the Football Association saw the rise of women's football as a threat.
In December of 1921, the FA banned women's football and effectively changed the course of the women's game forever. They didn't stop them from playing, but they banned them from using league grounds. They expressed their strong opinion that the game of football was quite unsuitable for females and should not be encouraged. And women's football was sort of cast out into the wilderness. If it would have been allowed to grow at the same level as the men's game was doing in the early 1920s, you know, who knows just what level we'd be playing at today.
Some doctors supported the clampdown on women's football, arguing that it was dangerous and could affect fertility. The Sex Disqualification Act of 1919 had allowed women to enter many middle-class professions, including the law, but for most working-class women, including footballers, the doors remained firmly closed. The FA finally lifted the ban on women playing on FA-affiliated grounds in 1971, 50 years after they'd imposed it. The First World War had transformed the status of women in Britain, and other sports reflected these changes. Fiona Skillen again.
Sport was an absolutely fundamental part of this new modernity. It was about celebrating the increased liberation and freedom that women were experiencing in this period. Sport provided a forum in which they could do that. Both middle and working class women are participating in this modernity and sport to differing degrees and in differing ways. Middle class women obviously have many more opportunities. They have the disposable income and time, which is a huge bonus to be able to participate in these activities, and they can join private clubs. Working class women, on the other hand, were participating, but in a slightly different way. They were doing it through work-based clubs and organisations, and also through municipal provision of sports facilities.
And these divisions began at school. Here's a pupil from a grammar school in the 1920s recalling her games lessons.
We did gymnastics all year through in a really well-equipped gym with bars and ropes and boxes and springboards. In winter, we played hockey and lacrosse. That was my favourite sport. And in the summer, we played cricket and some rounders and tennis.
For her fellow female athlete down the road at the elementary school, the experience was rather different.
We didn't do any real sports, just running races on sports day and sometimes a bit of dancing. We couldn't afford proper dress for sports, but we tucked our skirts into our knickers, and in the summer, we'd jump over ropes and roll across mats in the playground.
Around the same time, the Keep Fit movement took hold, and women in particular were fully involved. The Women's League of Health and Beauty was established in 1929. It allowed working women, mothers, single women, and everyone in between to find their own feet, their independence and their confidence through being active. Founded by Mary Bagot Stack, the league claimed to have 166,000 members in the 10 years leading up to the Second World War.
Women's League of Health and Beauty, London, calling. Mrs. Bagot Stack speaking. Our health and beauty exercises give you three important points. 1, continuous exercise. 2, musical movement. 3, joint loosening rather than muscle building.
Mary Bagot Stack wanted to give women the strength and the energy to make the world a better place to live, and to give them a physical freedom to express themselves. Between the wars, women set about redefining themselves from the corseted Victorian model of restraint. Their wages and their self-assurance were steadily rising. There continued to be discrimination and drudgery, but for an increasing number of women, sport was the key to another world, another way of being and looking. Fiona Skillen again.
Women could use sport to train and tone their bodies into these fashionable, sylph-like styles of the flapper, you know, very boyish shapes, very thin, not many contours. And so sport could provide a forum through which they could actually train to get their bodies into those shapes. It also provided an area in which they could socialise with other people, they could dress fashionably, and it really was very fashionable to be seen at these sporting events, not just as players but also as spectators.
Hiking became popular, as did swimming. And in 1926, an American 19-year-old called Gertrude Adel hit the headlines for swimming the English Channel. In terms of less challenging water-based events, the older Victorian baths became swimming pools with mixed bathing, and here there were galas for public entertainment. In Beckenham, on the suburban fringes of South London, the local paper reported on a mixed gala in 1930 where
Miss Coppard imitated a porpoise and a submarine, besides waltzing in the water. Mr. Wilkinson imitated a torpedo, a turtle having a sunbath, and a monkey on a stick.
Over the road from the factories, there's a lovely large garden area behind it, a couple of tennis courts, and lots of parking for cars. But this used to be where Cadbury provided thousands of racks for its workers' bikes. There were still profound differences between men's and women's sport, but just as mixed swimming was now acceptable, women were also finding a form of emancipation through cycling. By the 1930s, there were 10 million bicycles in Britain, and cycling was keenly taken up by working-class girls and women. The majority simply used their bikes for work or for casual recreation, but some joined clubs and competed. Dave Russell of Leeds Met University.
Probably several thousand became really serious competitors. A small number became sufficiently good to be tempted to become professionals. A woman called Billy Dovey, her achievement was to ride almost 30,000 miles in 1 year. There was also a woman called Lillian Dredge, and she went in for the Land's End to John O'Groats ride, 874 miles, and she set several records over that distance, which were then beaten literally days before the Second World War broke out by another professional cyclist called Marguerite Wilson, who actually completed the distance in just under 3 days. It's a popular route now for fundraisers, and the recommended time is about 10 to 14 days. So that gives you some kind of ideas of the level of ability and stamina that these young women could build up.
Those women who credit sport with improving their lives, or indeed those who make their living from sport, have the interwar women to thank. It was during those two decades, the 1920s and 30s, that British women cast aside Victorian restrictions and self-consciousness. They embraced modernity, taking a decisive step towards a wider emancipation of their bodies, their leisure, and their lives.
Thank you for downloading Sport and the British from the BBC.